Greetings and welcome to This Is Revolution. My name is Jean Bergelon, in for Jason Miles today, who is taking a well-earned rest. Now, before we begin today's show, I would like to remind people to like and subscribe to our channel. Do all the things that you are usually told to do at the beginning of YouTube videos, or if you're listening to the audio podcast, I believe you could also do similar things by getting notifications about our new shows whenever they come up. And of course, if you have the time or the ability or the extra cash, do consider supporting This Is Revolution on Patreon. As I always say, don't worry about it. No white people are paid in the production of This Is Revolution. So you are doing your reparations if you are supporting the show. Well, with that aside, we have an extremely exciting topic today to talk about, and that is about China's latest diplomatic maneuvers in the Middle East, its apparent brokering of an Iran-Saudi Arabia peace deal, and what this bodes for the future and China's involvement in the Middle East. Now, before we bring on our guest today, of course, I am not flying solo today. You're not stuck with the B team. We're bringing in our star player. I don't know what we're bringing our Mark Hughes. That's an early 90s football reference. We're bringing our Mark Hughes off TIR on the screen. The one, the only, Pascal Robert. Hey, Pascal, how are you doing?
What's going on? Peace and greetings to the audience, to the chat, and to Jean Bergelon. How are you, Jean?
I'm doing good. It's a beautiful day here in Missouri. The sun is not in the sky. It's drizzling, and I'm feeling homesick. This is just like Hull, you know? It's beautiful out there. The tear comes to my eye whenever I see the raindrops drop.
Yeah, we've been having some rainy weekends as well in South Florida. We're in rainy season. It's actually hurricane season. God, hopefully we don't get any of those.
Yeah, well, good luck in the hurricane season. So, Pascal, should we just jump straight to the guest today? And we should. So let me introduce our guest today, Bill Figueroa. Welcome, Bill. He is actually a newly minted assistant professor at Groningen University in Cambridge. He had his education at Rice University in Texas and finished his PhD at Penn, where we actually, I think we did cross paths at Penn.
We did.
I came and gave a talk about how the Kurds were never going to get a state at the end of the First World War, which is
I booked your train and your room for that. I was working at the Middle East Center at the time.
But then I didn't get to come. I had to do it by.
That's right. Yeah,
I had to do it. I didn't get my free trip to Pennsylvania, which is sad.
I got some bad news for you. The credit for that trip that just went right back to the Middle East Center. We used that for somebody else.
Oh, milked for my knowledge. But that's academia in general. It's like it's a mug's game. You write like 1,500 words of trash, you can get like $500 for it. You write 10,000 works of 10,000 words of deeply researched, you know, stuff, you don't get paid anything, and they threaten to take your job away if you don't write it. That's how they keep you in check. Well, anyway, Bill is an expert on Sino-Iranian relations. He's written on the history of the Iranian left and its relationship with China. He's familiar with it. He is one of the rare individuals who's familiar with not one, but two Oriental languages. So he is a true Orientalist in the best sense of the word, in the best sense of he does both Middle and Far East. And you hopefully down the road, we may have you back on if you enjoy yourself this time to talk more about the kind of historical aspects of China's relationship with Iran and the Iranian left. But today we wanted to focus on this kind of news that is floating around about China's increased involvement in the Middle East. Of course, we've had this recent agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which was brokered by China. There's talk of a a Chinese peace plan in Palestine. There's questions about, you know, can China intervene meaningfully in Yemen? And then, of course, there's the question of investment and, you know, what Iran and China's relationship is going to be economically. How does the Shanghai Organization figure into this? And what does this mean for the United States? And I think, you know, when we talk about this topic, there is a kind of very interesting sort of similarity in position, if not in the normative values, between elements of the left and elements of the right, who are, you know, the right are like, China is coming into the Middle East and stealing our lunch. We've got to push back on China. And that's a bad thing. And then there are people on the left who are like, no, China is like coming in. We're going towards this multipolar world. China is going to play a kind of a stabilizing force in the Middle East, whereas the United States has been a disruptive force. And that's a positive thing. And, you know, from what I've read, from what you've written, it's you're not really taking any kind of side in that kind of discussion, and rather talking about both the, you know, let's say the quote unquote positive aspects of Chinese intervention, but also the fact that, you know, some of this discussion about China becoming the guarantor of the Middle East and Middle Eastern stability is a little bit perhaps premature. So, you know, before we get to the sort of questions about present day politics and these present day diplomatic maneuvers, can you perhaps talk a little bit about the recent history of China's relationship with Iran and also Saudi Arabia? You know, what has been going on in the last, you know, 20, 30 years in terms of China's involvement in the Middle East, especially since China sort of moved away from the more autarkic form of modernization towards integrating itself into the global economy? How has this impacted China's role in the Middle East?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I just want to say that somebody in the chat said that I look like a cross between Dave Grohl and David Cross, who had a son. That might be the best compliment I've ever gotten. So thank you, whoever you
are. I see it. I definitely see it.
So as to the history, yeah. So Iran and China's modern relationship started in the 1970s. It was a kind of interesting story in which, you know, a communist dictatorship has a relationship with a monarchy, which is not something that one might automatically expect, but at the time was very common in China's foreign policy, especially after the turn away from a more ideologically oriented foreign policy in some of the earlier eras, when they were partially looking at things through the lens of where in the region is ripe for revolution and where can we support groups that might overturn the governments there, to a more state-centered approach where they're focusing on relations between states, because fundamentally what they're after is the ascension in the UN. Basically, they're looking for to get a critical mass of votes, amongst other things, but that's their main interest in the Middle East. The Middle East, like many other places, has many, many newly decolonized states, so there's a lot of people they can get on board with them, basically. So they approached China. I won't get into all of the details of that. It has a little bit to do with the attempts of some Iranian revolutionaries on the left, Maoists, who traveled to China, who were caught up in an assassination attempt against the Shah and were sort of subsequently blamed for that. And the Shah reached out to China partially as a way to kind of take the wind out of the sails of those Maoist opposition groups, who were making up the bulk of the most vocal and radical elements of the opposition at the time, at least until the death of Mao. It was a pretty successful strategy because subsequent to that, the Maoist movement in Iran kind of lost most of its success. After that, the two countries developed relations at a very low level, and it was actually in 1978 Deng Xiaoping visited, Hua Guofeng, who was Mao's successor, visited the Shah about, I think, 6 months before the revolution came. And this was at a time when it was extraordinarily obvious that the situation in Iran was not very good. The ambassador at the time, Hua Liming, he recalled a really interesting moment where they were supposed to go on this kind of like a a limousine ride through the streets of Tehran, but they couldn't because there were crowds in the streets, you know, chanting, you know, Maj Shah and all that kind of stuff. And so they ended up having to take a helicopter to get to their destination. And when they got in the helicopter, there were actually five other helicopters that all flew off in different directions. So this was not the normal diplomatic protocol at the time. And it was really clear to the Chinese that this was not a stable situation. And they paid for this a little bit. Immediately after the revolution, the Islamic Republic was not interested in establishing relations with China. Khomeini said something like, you know, the Chinese came and visited the Shah at a time when the streets were running red with the blood of the Iranian youth. So they had to sort of play against this for a while. But really, it was the Iran-Iraq war that brought China into Iran in a real way. Iran needed money and they needed weapons, and China was willing to provide them. And after the war, they played a very large role in the reconstruction effort. Famously, the Tehran Metro, for example, was built with Chinese engineers. After that, you had a period in which there's a kind of balancing act for China between its relations with the U.S. and its relations with Iran. It goes up, it goes down. Generally speaking, China's interested in Iran as a piece of its overall strategy of engaging with countries in the Middle East and, you know, strategic locations around the world, but it's not a sort of center of gravity, so to speak. There's a number of times where, you know, China was buying oil from Iran, or China was offering to sell missiles to Iran, that subsequent to U.S. pressure, those deals collapsed. Typically, you kind of see a sort of seesaw relationship where when relations between the U.S. and China are not good, they're more willing to engage with Iran, because there's not as much of a political cost. If the political cost is basically, you know, the U.S. gets pissed off at you, well, they're already pissed off at us. So what's the cost of doing it? And you get the added benefit of, you know, where we're thumbing our noses, we're sticking our fingers in the eye of the empire, and, you know, they don't want us to buy the oil. Well, you know, we don't believe in sanctions. We're going to buy the oil. So this goes on for a while, and until you get to, you know, the kind of the modern era where you start to really see, actually when I got into studying Iran and China was about 10 years ago. It was the first time, maybe 15 now, I like to think I'm less old than I am. It was really the first time in like the early 2000s that you started to hear about China and Iran in the same breath as this kind of like anti-Western, anti-US alliance, and in particular one that by purchasing Iranian oil, China was undermining U.S. Sanctions in the region, and et cetera, et cetera. Since then, there's been this sort of growing sense of crisis in Washington, this growing sense of this is like the new axis of evil. And that story, so to speak, really came to a head in 2021, when they signed the 25-year Iran-China Strategic Cooperation Agreement that was widely said to be, you know, worth $400 billion. I'm here to tell you today that that number is found nowhere in any of the documentation. And since that deal has been signed, there's been something like $145 million of investment in Iran. So they're not really on track, I don't think, to make $400 billion in 25 years. And that kind of brings me to the point about contemporary relations, is that while the rhetoric and in fact sometimes what the government say is you know, very positive towards Sino-Iranian relations, in reality, the Chinese are not super keen on investing and spending a lot of money in Iran, at least not in ways that don't benefit or they are interested in ways that benefit them, but they're not interested in ways that expose them to risk. So they're willing to improve trade relations with Iran. Iran has become sort of flooded in a lot of ways with Chinese products. Chinese cars actually recently is kind of a new thing. But they're not really willing to invest. And it's pretty obvious why. I mean, the sanctions make it really difficult, especially after, for example, the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive, who was arrested in Canada on charges related to evading the sanctions in Iran. So there's this tension between the desire of China to engage with Iran in a way that is beneficial to their sort of overall strategy, and the desire on the part of Iran to look to China, you know, the Nigah Beshabh strategy, the look to the East strategy, as a kind of savior, right? We can't look to the West. We have to look to the East. They can buy our oil. They can pull us out of this, this quagmire that we're in terms of our political situation. I think it's a bit overblown. Like you said, I'm not really taking a position in the sense that if the two positions are the sky is falling and that's terrible, or and the sky is falling and that's not and that's great. You know, I'm here to tell you the sky's probably not coming down as quickly as you think it might be. So that's where I think things remain to this day. China is very important to Iran. Iran is not as important to China, and China is not investing in Iran as heavily as they would like, and as much as they expected after the signing of several of those deals over the last few years.
So, you know, what you're saying is that while China might be interested in working with Iran, Iran is just, there are just better markets for them to invest in, ones with less, that are going to bring about less problems for them. Is that, you know, they're not willing to go to bat to support Iran at the moment, because that might foreclose other opportunities around the world.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly the biggest problem is, why would you invest in Iran when Saudi Arabia is right next door, where you can get the same kinds of deals in a country? And also, you know, all of the Gulf countries, you know, most of the GCC has stronger legal regimes, the legal protections, more developed financial services, technology. I mean, Huawei and ZTE both have headquarters in the Middle East, and they are located in, I believe, the UAE and Bahrain, respectively. So there's a lot of attraction to the GCC, not so much to Iran.
Right. So China's orientation is generally towards these more, let's say, open markets in the Middle East. Countries which have been generally pro-American, but, you know, are pursuing more independent foreign policies at the moment, have some leverage over the United States to a certain degree. And so the reaction from the United States to, let's say, investing in the Gulf is going to be less, and there's more opportunities for China to secure the resources that it wants, which is the oil. So There is perhaps a will to invest in China, but that will is not strong enough, let's say, to overcome the risks. As you said, you know, they don't want to, you know, try. And I think this is a point that we've talked about before. China, you know, is quite, you know, conservative, or we could say responsible when it comes to its engagement of in the international arena, and you know that they are not trying to get themselves into anything that could blow back on them in a significant way.
Yeah, and certainly more so than the United States in terms of how they've behaved towards Middle Eastern countries and how they've participated in various conflicts. I mean, the worst you can really say in the story that I'm telling is that, you know, Iran sold weapons to both sides during the Iran, or China sold weapons to both sides during the Iran-Iraq war, but so did the United States and Russia, and they did so at a much greater volume. So I do generally see see China as more likely to play a stabilizing role. You know, it's certainly not, I wouldn't say that it's actively stabilizing things, but it's certainly not a destabilizing factor.
Bill, I wanted to ask you, do you think that part of the motivation that China may have for actually getting into some level of interaction with Iran may be around the expansion of the Belt and Road Initiative? Do you think that there's any justification whatsoever that China would have in wanting to invest in Iran? Or what reciprocation could Iran see in itself in having benefit from China being involved in its development? Is there anything that we might be missing here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, first of all, the Belt and Road Initiative, it's important to remember, it is, like many Chinese initiatives, it is a kind of, you know, it's a blank slate, you know, an empty container that you can kind of pour anything into. Many of the Belt and Road projects that we see today were already happening, and when they came up with the concept of Belt and Road, and they kind of just built it around that. So there is an overarching strategy of engaging with all of these countries in the world, but it's not as directly as directed, or you know, part of sort of a larger big picture. It's more of a big picture strategy than like an individual, okay, first we're going to do this and then we're going to go there. In terms of what China wants to get out of Iran, oil obviously is a big one, but like we said, they can get that elsewhere. Their interests are more towards, I think, Iran as a potential market. It's a great market for Chinese goods. It's also one that's relatively easy for them to get into because the West has largely excluded itself from that market. Although there are problems with that, because the Iranians themselves have a very clearly stated preference for European products. In fact, so much so that part of the negative debate about China, you know, relations with China in Iran, is that Iranians sort of say, you know, 20 years ago we had access to, you know, the best European products and things like that, and now we have nothing but cheap Chinese crap on our on all of the mall shelves, you know. So it kind of highlights this sense of, we are not living up to our potential. We deserve more than this. We shouldn't have to deal with this because the government's policies are, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a common complaint on the reformist side, for example. In terms of what Iran can get out of this, it's Iran lacks the capacity to complete a lot of, you know, investment projects that could be developed. There's a lot of oil, a lot of gas, and also just domestic, you know, manufacturing that could be built up with Chinese investment, and they simply lack the sources of development capital. And it's not only China that can provide that. Right now, actually, Russia is the number one investor in Iran. And since the normalization deal, one of the big things they've discussed is bringing in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi Investment Fund to finance projects in Iran. So it really just comes down to, they have things they could do, but they lack the money or the expertise to do it. And China is one of the things that could provide that. Symbolically, it also is obviously a big win for, like I said, the look east strategy. They kind of want to say, we don't need you. We can look towards China anytime that we want. In reality, I think China is a little bit more hesitant to embrace them in that way. There is also, just really quick, there is also the idea that Iran will be a kind of transit hub. And this is something that the Iranians like this idea a lot, between China and Chinese products and the rest of the Middle East and the Mediterranean. And that is true. If China were to develop the transportation infrastructure in Iran and connect their networks to it in the ways that they're describing, that would be a big boon on the Iranian economy. Because there isn't a good direct access to that right now.
So there's something I wanted to pick up on what you said. So you hinted about some of the discord in Iran regarding the shift towards China. And I think perhaps what might surprise people is that the political lines around who is for and who is against China perhaps don't map onto what people would assume. And there are voices, not just on the kind of reformist side, that are skeptical of a shift towards China, but also on the conservative side. I mean, I think Ahmadinejad has been skeptical about China. Iran has a long history of, fears about imperial powers. And when the Iranian Revolution happened, you know, it was primarily directed against the United States, but also there was deep hostility towards Soviet-style communism. There are some hardliners who are critical of this deal. Can you perhaps elaborate on what the, let's say, conservative critique of shifting towards China is? And what is their alternative, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the conservative critique of it has largely just been that it's ineffective. I mean, it's they talk about, you know, the excessive trust in Russia and China, and that it's not actually going to result in not just the investment, but for the conservatives, it's more of a security issue. The idea that looking to China and looking to, you know, China to play a role, especially, you know, in light of the Saudi Iran deal, was not a positive development, that they couldn't trust Saudi Arabia, that this was actually a negative development in terms of Iran's security situation. There's also some criticism, you know, from the sort of ultra revolutionary types, where actually someone just said it in the chat, it's not left versus right, it's east versus west. You have, you know, the people kind of returning to this slogan of, you know, Nashar Nakar Fakat Jumhuriya Islami, you know, just not neither east nor west.
Islamic Republic.
Yes. this is kind of the I think the main criticism coming from those supporters, that, you know, we don't want to just lean to the east. We want to go our own way. And, you know, we can't rely on China for that. We can't rely on anyone. Iran has to stand on its own two feet. There's also the Ahmadinejad's kind of critique, which is, I think, more populist than conservative, although he is himself a conservative figure, where it really boils down to saying things like, this secret deal, we don't know what's in it, we don't trust the Chinese, and it's very much kind of hinting at, you know, this is a new Treaty of Turkmenchai. Some of the rumors surrounding it were that, like, there are going to be 5,000 Chinese troops stationed in Iran. They're going to sell the island of Kish to the Chinese. The Chinese are going to be burying nuclear waste in the desert. You know, so these sorts of rumors that are popular in Iranian society, you know, mixed in with a little bit of xenophobia as well, is a very, you know, kind of popular thing. Plus some of the, like I said, the lack of desire for Chinese products and the notion that this is not a reflection of Iran's prestige, that's not something that maps easily onto reformist or conservative. There are a lot of people that feel that way. So yeah, there's a lot of opposition. I would say there's probably more opposition to it than there is support of it. You know, especially when you consider that the most common reformist position is we should be developing relations with all sides, not just leaning to Russia and China.
And just so people are aware, the Treaty of Turkmenchai was a treaty signed with the Russians in the early 19th century, which basically forced open the Iranian market that offered the Russians kind of major sort of political concessions for their citizens operating within Iran. And, you know, like many countries in the Middle East, there is a lot of paranoia about these kind of unequal treaties, which there is a deep history of signed, you know, that it was signed with the West. And obviously, there are elements of the Iranian population who fear that perhaps China is doing what the, you know, what the Europeans did in the 19th century. So I think probably, you know, it hits a kind of Iranian nationalist button, because, you know, when people think, and I don't know if you agree with this, Bill, but when people talk about Iran, you know, it's often through this lens of East versus West, and it's often people project onto Iranian politics their own preconceptions about global affairs, as opposed to looking at Iran in and of itself. For example, the nuclear issue is a good example. It's because the Iranians, you know, reformist and anti-Islamic Republic Iranians would also probably like Iran to have a nuclear weapon because it's a prestige issue. So, you know, there's, I think some of these things don't always map on perfectly to what people might assume is the default positions.
Absolutely. And I don't know why you would think that I wouldn't agree with that, because that's absolutely true. That's people kind of project onto the situation. And in fact, I should point out that these nationalists are projecting. There's no truth to any of those rumors that I mentioned. Some of them are just patently ridiculous, like the idea that they would sell the island of Kish. So that's kind of why I say there's this like sort of element of xenophobia there. It's a little bit of like, you know, it's a yellow peril. The Chinese are coming, you know, but it's an understandable one, because as you say, it really plugs into these, you know, these anxieties. And, you know, when they say it's the new Treaty of Turkmenchai, like I can understand why that's, you know, what they're tapping into. And this plays very well, or I should say, this is, very popular on, for example, the Iranian Twitter sphere, social media and things like that. It gets retweeted hundreds and thousands of times, and people start to think that that's actually what's happening. Go ahead. Sorry.
What I wanted to ask you, Bill, is that in the same way that we're seeing this kind of, you know, trepidation on the part of the Iranians in terms of dealing with China, it seems like the Saudis are less kind of worried about those type of problems and dealing with them, and are much more open to engage with China to the point where they're willing to help them negotiate peace deals with the Iranians as well. One of the things that I really like to really put out on the table, because we've talked about it on this show to various reactions, because there seems to be an inconsistency with those who call themselves to be members of the left on this concept of multipolarity and what it actually means. Some are celebrating this move by China to be brokering this type of peace arrangement between Saudi Arabia and Iran as evidence of what is the best of this concept of quote-unquote multipolarity, which is the rise of a new Western kind of Eastern, and now Eastern broker of affairs, whether it be Russia or China, and that this is demonstration of how well this new state of affairs can work. Others are saying that it's really not much more of a demonstration of anything. Are we seeing the possibility that with the rise of China negotiating between Saudi Arabia and Iran, a new type of constellation on the horizon, or a new polarity, multipolarity, if you will, that may have a portention in the future of different ends in terms of where we go with global negotiations, much more different than we would have had with the United States being the head man in charge?
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge debate right now. I mean, the idea of multipolarity, and this, you know, this also gets into China's, you know, kind of, we talked about Iran's kind of, you know, colonial sensitivities. This gets into China's as well. You know, their equivalent of the Treaty of Turkmenchai, I saw someone mention it in the chat. It's called the Bupingdeng Tiaoyue, the unequal treaties, you know. So they have this history as well. And they also have this idea, this vision of, you know, that we can create a world in which, you know, the West does not throw its weight around, does not have so much influence, and we can move into a new direction. Now, I think that there is some truth to it, and there is some caveats to it in terms of are we seeing a multipolar moment, or is this evidence of multipolarity, specifically this China brokered Iran Saudi deal, as they're often calling it. So I think that there's absolutely some truth to the fact that this is an example of China playing a larger role in the Middle East, and that in the future, having the option of China is something that will allow Middle Eastern states to have a little bit more maneuverability, especially in terms of economic deals. Primarily, I would say, in terms of economic deals. As you said, the Saudis are not being shy in sort of throwing themselves into deals with China at the moment. But I think that there's some limitations to this. First of all, the deal, the Beijing brokered deal, I mean, there's a reason why we emphasize brokered, because it was largely hashed out between Iran and Saudi Arabia for years prior to this. The negotiations began sometime in 2019, shortly after an incident, which I'm sure many of you remember, where almost half of Saudi Arabia's oil production capacity was taken offline by a high-profile drone attack that was blamed on the Houthis, that was blamed on being supported by Iran. And, you know, subsequently, literally the month after that was when they started discussing, you know, the possibility of turning down the heat. They were negotiating in Baghdad for a while, and then things kind of fell apart for a number of different reasons, partially because of political changes in Iraq. The new Iraqi prime minister was seen as being more on, you know, associated with Iran. So the Saudis didn't want to continue negotiations there. They kind of lost their neutral table to sit at, so to speak. And there were also issues of the Saudis just not trusting the Chinese, or not trusting the Iranians. So China, bringing in China to sort of underwrite the deal, a deal that had largely been hammered out already, a deal that was being driven largely by regional processes. You know, Iran wants to turn down the heat because they're facing a protest, they're facing a flailing economy. You know, there's a lot of reasons why the possibility of escalating tensions with Saudi Arabia could cause trouble for the Iranian government. The Saudis, you know, for their part, they want to implement, you know, this Vision 2030. They want to, you know, build all these new economic projects. For that, they need money, and the war in Yemen was bleeding them dry. And they need to not have things like all of their oil capability, half their oil capabilities being taken offline, spooking investors and driving them away from investing there. So in a lot of ways, you know, I see this as Saudi Arabia kind of saying, okay, we lost. I mean, the real winners here are the Houthis in terms of, you know, who's getting more freedom of action out of this deal, out of all the parties involved. So bringing in China to underwrite the deal was a way to kind of allow the Saudis to be satisfied that, you know, China would, I think they think that China might do something if Iran stepped out of line. I think realistically that's not likely to happen. But even just the idea that if they want to attract Chinese investment, you know, they can't embarrass China by, you know, violating this deal clearly. And then also just the very simple fact that they lost the place that they had to negotiate, and they needed a place where they could meet. Well, they couldn't meet in the United States. That's obviously a non-starter due to the status of relations. China plays a perfect role. They have good relations with Iran. They have good relations with Sorry, my headphone fell out. They have good relations with Iran. They have good relations with Saudi Arabia. And crucially, from Saudi Arabia's perspective, they are perceived to have influence over Iran and not that much influence over Saudi Arabia. There's not really much China could do to sort of turn the screws on Saudi Arabia other than threaten to pull out of some of these deals that it's very unlikely to want to pull out of. So fundamentally, this was just kind of them going to Beijing and signing the paperwork. They hashed it out over 4 days. I mean, 4 days tells you that a lot of these issues were discussed ahead of time. So it's not incredibly significant in the sense that China did not come in and through its skillful diplomacy and through throwing its weight around or making suggestions or offering inducements, bring this deal to fruition. It was a deal that was basically happening anyway, and China played a role in bringing it across the finish line. Now, I think that is significant because without that negotiating table, it's hard to say whether the deal would have happened right now or when it would have happened, whether it would have even happened at all. These sorts of things are very contingent and very fast moving. But I don't think it's true that this is going to herald a new era of, you know, sort of Eastern brokered, you know, peace agreements and things like that. And certainly not in Palestine. And we can talk more about those the 4, 5, 6, whatever point plans that they release later. But fundamentally, I think that I would just say that it was a regional agreement. You know, I called it in one article a regional deal with Chinese characteristics. And it's not going to fundamentally alter the balance of power in the region, although the rise of China there gives these states a bit more choice, a bit more room to maneuver, and some new sources of money and investment that the West was not always willing to offer.
How do you think it's going to be perceived by the international community or the foreign policy elites in the West, if you will?
I can tell you how it's being perceived by them. They're freaking out. I mean, the immediate response to this was actually like, this is a terrible thing. I mean, there were some people basically saying, you know, more or less that this would be great if it didn't involve China. and kind of, you know, shit talking the deal, basically. And they quickly changed that. I think they got a bit of blowback from some of their Western allies, amongst others. And they kind of changed their tune to like, hey, you know what? You want to do it, China? Go for it. You know, you want to wade into this? Yeah, good luck. You know, peace in the Middle East? Yeah, we tried. It doesn't work very easily. I think both of these are kind of fronting, right? You know, one was a kind of, you know, immediate knee-jerk reaction. And the other one is like, well, we've had a second to think about this, and this is how we want to look right now. I think in reality, you're looking at kind of a mixture of the two. They aren't upset to see Saudi Arabia and Iran reduce tensions. They are upset, very much so, to see China playing a larger role in the region. I recall I was speaking with someone, I can't say who, because it was a sort of closed door meeting, but they said, you know, why doesn't Biden just go over there and tell the Saudis not to, you know, it's us or them, basically. And I didn't have a chance to say at the time, but I was kind of thinking to myself, well, he sort of did do that. You know, Biden went over there and said, you know, warned against, you know, closer relations with China. And what did the Saudis do? You know, a couple months later, they invited Xi Jinping to come with the full purple carpet treatment. So I think that there is a bit of a concern in the West. They do perceive a sort of shifting of the political winds. I think it's overblown. I don't think Saudi Arabia or any of the GCC countries with close relations with the U.S. are seeking to replace the U.S. with China for so many reasons that I could get into. But they're just looking to expand their options. They're looking to, you know, I mean, do what I think is actually normal and natural for any country to do, which is to seek out its, you know, the maximum benefit in the situation that it finds itself in.
Do you think that part of the kind of bad blood that the Saudis found themselves in with the United States is a result of certain other developments? For example, the Jamal Khashoggi situation, the fact that the United States was kind of tepid in terms of the financing of the Yemen war, the new leadership in Saudi not exactly, you know, being as affectionate towards the U.S. as they had been in the past. Do you think there could be other factors that could explain this kind of shift towards a more friendly to the Chinese perception amongst the Saudis than what other affairs on the ground are demonstrating?
Sorry, you cut out a little bit at the very end there. I didn't quite catch like the actual question piece of the question.
Well, I said, do you think that there could be other effects, other things besides the affairs on the ground that we're seeing now? For example, realpolitik between the United States and Saudi Arabia, particularly with the Jamal Khashoggi and a few
others. Yes. Yeah, I do think that, you know, I actually wrote a piece on this that, you know, Xi Jinping's visit to Saudi Arabia is not just about U.S. relations, U.S.-Saudi relations, because that was the narrative at the time. This was before the deal was brokered, so people were very much focused on that. And there are other factors, you know, like like I said, I think they're kind of just pursuing what they think is a good source of investment. But it is very much in that context as well. It is partially about U.S.-Saudi relations. And as you pointed out, you know, the Saudis are not particularly pleased with the U.S. administration right now. I do personally think this is a little bit of noise, a little bit of issues of maybe respect and how they're perceiving their treatment. It's not based on, for example, Saudi Arabia actually thinking and calculating that China sells a lot of weapons in the Middle East. Don't get me wrong. It's actually one of the, if it's not the number one, it's one of the number one arms brokers. But it doesn't offer the kinds of like systems and missile defense technology that the United States has set up in Saudi Arabia. And so the idea that China is going to replace the US in that regard is just, it's a non-starter. Never mind the fact that they would have to replace all of this US infrastructure and technology that's already in place, because Chinese technology doesn't just fit in and play nice with, you know, with U.S. military technology. So there's, I think, a little bit of you know, I hesitate to use this term because everybody has a different idea of what it means, but of playing the China card. And by which I mean moving towards relations with China that are genuine, that are not just being done for show, but taking that option partially because of the message that it sends to the United States and the thought that, well, you know, one possibility here is that the United States may give us more of what we want. And I do think that's true. There's a lot of reports of like Saudi Arabia is going to be investing less in the US and is going to be investing more in China over the next few years. I think that they will be investing more in China. I don't know that they're going to be substantially cutting back on their investment in the US or not welcoming US investment in their country. I think they're just going to be adding China to the picture.
Diversifying their portfolio of sovereign fund investments,
which is to diversify your bonds.
Exactly. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, and along with this China brokered deal, which from what I understand you're saying is basically China was the umbrella that could facilitate this deal that there was already a lot of motivation to have done, and China, because of its unique position, was basically the only major power that could serve as a kind of broker for this. And so their role, it's very different, difficult to run counterfactuals, but at the very least, you know, their role facilitated a detente between these countries that may have taken longer otherwise. They sort of acted as a kind of stabilizing force. Now, another thing that people have been talking about a lot is the Israel-Palestine question and China coming in offering its kind of proposal for the the Israel-Palestine issue. But it seems to me, though, that, you know, just as Saudi Arabia is diversifying its portfolio, Israel is also diversifying its portfolio. As you said at the outset, China in the post-Mao era moved away from a more ideologically orientated foreign policy where they would dump money into a railway in Zimbabwe?
Zambia. Tanzan Railway.
Tanzan Railway. They dump money into the Tanzan Railway for political reasons. Whereas now, it's a kind of different orientation. And China has relations with Israel. Can you talk about how Israel and China are developing and how this peace plan fits in?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a common thing that comes up. I mean, the first thing that I will just say, just to get it out of the way, there's to me, Israel, Palestine, and Saudi Arabia, Iran are fundamentally different situations. And same with Ukraine, because China is also, you know, sort of offered to negotiate or not to negotiate, but to facilitate between Ukraine and Russia. The main difference being that in the case of Saudi Arabia and Iran, both sides wanted to come to the table, wanted to negotiate, and were looking for a sponsor, basically. In Ukraine and Russia, that is not the case. In Israel-Palestine, that is very much not the case. Israel has neither the desire to negotiate with the Palestinians to begin with, and if it did, it has no desire, I think, to bring in China, who is fundamentally more close to the Palestinians than the United States. I won't say that they are more close to the Palestinians than they are to Israel, but they are close. They are viewed as, probably correctly, as more invested in the Palestinian cause, than the United States, which is quite clearly more invested in the Israeli cause. I do think that the fundamental issue here is that China has really good relations with Israel. I mean, very good relations. Israel is in a lot of ways the R&D, lab of China. A lot of Chinese companies don't have the capacity to sort of like develop the technology that they want to use in China. So they hire that out to Israel and then they bring that technology back. There's also a long history of tech transfer between both. Israel provided China with some military technology in the 80s and 90s that the United States wasn't willing to provide to China. And that was a big issue for the United States. And that is why I think you see what's happening now, which is while Israel is trying, or was, you might even say, trying to develop its relations with China to a certain extent, they increasing trade relations. It's not the biggest trade relationship that China has, but it's a significant one because of the R&D and the high tech component of it. But also, the Israeli military was like buying Chinese drones and things like that. The United States got very, very wary about this, sort of warned Israel off of it. And it seems to have more or less worked in the sense that they are slowing down on that. I think that they are trying to kind of prove to the US, like, we're being really careful, we're doing our due diligence, we're not just like rushing into a contract with Huawei that's going to allow them to spy on us. If we accept it, then it's you don't have to worry, basically. But it is certainly slowing that down a little bit. this is this great story. One of the big issues was that the Chinese were apparently going to invest in the port of Haifa. And the United States got very cagey about this, and they basically communicated to the Israelis not to allow them to do that. They're trying to use it as a listening post, trying to use it to spy or whatever. And there was an ex-Israeli intelligence official that spoke to one of the newspapers that said something like, look, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. If the Chinese want to spy in Haifa, they'll do what everybody else does. They'll rent an apartment. They don't have to buy a whole port. So there's definitely some outsized fear of Israeli-China relations again on the part of the U.S., but it's effective because Israel's relationship with the United States is incredibly important, and so they are a little bit more hesitant than, say, Saudi Arabia to look east than a lot of these other countries are. But they have a great relationship, and China has next to no leverage over Israel, next to no ability to induce Israel to invite it to come in and play negotiator. So it's just not going to happen. And at the end of the day, you have to remember that Chinese peace proposals are not, they don't have teeth, they don't have steps, they don't really have anything. They're fundamentally just, all the sides should call a ceasefire, you should come to the negotiating table, and then you should hash it out based on your personal interest or your individual interests. And you have to be the ones to make those decisions, because China, and this is again part of its sort of propaganda, its appeal, its rhetoric, we don't impose our decisions on other countries. We will provide the forum in which you can negotiate. I think that is true to an extent, but it also means that in situations where there is no will to negotiate, China has no role to play.
And would you say then from that, if anything, China needs a good relationship with Israel because Israel serves as a vector for Western technology transfer? So it's Israel, yes, as a key node in this. I mean, China and the United States are having this technology conflict. Some of the rhetoric around Chinese American relations have cooled down, perhaps, but still there's the fear that America is going to lock China out of certain technological innovations, and Israel is an important sort of node for getting that Western technology. So Israel actually has, A, can make money out of China, so doesn't want to burn out its Chinese relations. And for China, it needs Israel to get access to certain high-tech technologies.
Exactly. And not even like, you know, it's not even just as clandestine and cloak and daggers as, you know, like this technology that the US won't share. It's just as simple as, you know, China, I mean, a Chinese company might have an idea for a new, you know, a new product or a new part that they want to engineer for a product that they're making, and they just don't have the R&D capabilities to produce it and engineer it and test it and get it to market. So Israel does. You could do it in Israel, and then you bring the plans back and you manufacture them in China. And that's a great way to do it.
So in terms of the overall geostrategic effect of these machinations, do you think that the perception that we're seeing a kind of sundown over American empire and the rise of the sun over the East, if you will, that is being so commonly touted by voices on the left. I mean, it's kind of almost kind of ridiculous to the point where you hear people talking about, like, you know, the end of Western hegemony is over. You know, it's all, you know, the fall of the West. This combined with what's going on in Ukraine. How do you deem this? I mean, you're the expert on these kind of Sino-Iranian and Sino-Saudi relations. How do you view? Do you see this as a legitimate potential moment for changing the nature of the dynamics? Friend of show Daniel Bessner has actually agreed that we are in a moment of waning American influence in the world, and that he wouldn't be shocked if we did pivot to a greater China role or hegemonic role. Do you see that as being a possibility? Where does your instincts take you in terms of prognosticating?
Well, one nice thing is I am here on the This Is Revolution podcast, so I can be a little more open with what I think than I sometimes am on more academic podcasts, and tell you that I would probably be one of the first people to be very happy to see the American empire have less influence in the Middle East and on some of these countries than it does. I often say it like this. I do think that we are seeing the beginning of the end of the American empire, or the beginning of the end of American, I would say, hegemonic influence in the Middle East. I don't think we're there yet. It is waning, I think, is a fair way to put it. But I don't think we are in a position where the US has lost interest in the Middle East enough that it's just going to pack up and leave and allow China to sort of take its place in that respect. And I think China has neither the political will nor the capability, the military, the financial even capability to replicate the United States sort of security blanket, whatever you want to call it, the quote unquote rules-based international order in which the United States makes up all the rules and the points don't matter, or whatever you want to call it. I don't think that they can replicate that. I mean, they have like one rinky-dink military base in Djibouti. It's got like 40 people in it. The whole idea of the string of pearls, they're going to build all these military bases. I think this is more aspirational than actual something they can do in the near term. So in terms of the most aggressive prediction of that, you know, China, maybe you could say even the conservative, way of looking at that, that the American empire is ending and China is going to come in and be the hegemonic military power. And it's going to just be America, but it's China this time. I don't think that's what they're going to do. I don't think they want to do that. If you read Chinese think tanks and strategic planners and internal documents, they don't. Not only do they not want to do that, but they locate a lot of the sources of America's current issues in the world. Its domestic problems, its financial issues, its political issues, its lack of appeal around the world to the role that it's tried to play in the Middle East as world police, and also as the guarantor that it's sort of said for itself as of international maritime security. So I think that they want to find a new way to go about having relations with these countries. I don't think that means that they don't want to, you know, have an influence that is allows them to kind of set the tone or set the terms of the debates that are going to be had, or set the formats or the technology that's going to be used by the region. But I think they want to do it in a very different way, not by surrounding it with military bases, because it's just, they don't have the money and it hasn't happened yet, or it hasn't been good for America. I also don't think that you're seeing the American Empire end in the sense of like American power is waning and we don't have the case. I just think it's moving. I mean, we're more concerned with China right now. This sort of, we announced the pivot to Asia, you know, what was like a decade ago, and next to nothing happened. But now you're actually starting to see that. You're starting to see a, you know, concentration of American interest more on Asia, more on, you know, resources and things, on the fear that war is going to break out in Taiwan. So I think that the Middle East is maybe lowering as an area of concern, also partially because, you know, the U.S. has energy independence or close to it now. So it's less of a strategic concern in that respect. But it remains a strategic concern in the sense that if we're worried about China and we're worried that we're going to go to war with China at some point in a very simple, fundamental way, you know, the U.S. is, its position has always been, you know, we're the top dog and we have to stay that way. So maintaining the influence in the Middle East and the ability to cut off oil flows to China in the event of a conflict is still a major part of the U.S. strategy. And for that reason, I think what you're currently seeing is the U.S. using every resource at its disposal to slow down China, the growth of China in this area, and sort of shore up what influence that it still has and what is remaining. Now, it remains to be seen if we are seeing the beginning of like a, you know, UK on the collision course with the Suez Crisis kind of moment, you know, where something's going to happen that's going to fundamentally alter that balance of power. But I can definitively say it hasn't happened yet, and the Saudi-Iran deal is not it.
And I mean, is there a sense as well there's kind of a contradiction in Chinese policy in the sense that they may want the United States to be bogged down in the Middle East so it can't fully pivot to Asia, while at the same time they may have, you know, material interests. I mean, they don't want to have to deploy their navy to ensure that their ships going around the Horn of Africa don't get the "I'm the captain now" treatment, right? They can leave that to the U.S. Navy.
Yes.
Why commit Chinese resources when someone else's, when the United States Navy is subsidizing the security of the sea lanes, which allows China to operate without having to protect its own mercantile fleet?
Yes, this is exactly true. China is often accused of free riding off of the U.S. security system, and it is 100% an accurate accusation. That, you know, it benefits China. In many ways, I often look at China as, you know, this is very kind of jargony, but like in terms of it being a revolutionary versus a reformist power, you know, in terms of how it approaches the international system, I think it's more reformist in the sense that it wants to alter it in a way that China has a bigger piece of the pie, but it still is able to benefit from it in the same way, right? China has identified that it benefits from this system, but it also exposes it to risks. And increasingly, in the last couple of years under Xi Jinping, those risks are being seen as unacceptable. So they want to reform the international system in a more multipolar way, meaning that there are more centers of power that can, you know, be at the table and not allow the United States or the West to just sort of set the agenda and kind of, you know, form alternative, not replacement, but alternative structures. I think that's very much, you know, what it's kind of trying to do here. You know, I lost my train of thought, but it must not have been that important.
Pascal?
No, I really appreciate you being able to fill in these blanks, because a lot of people, they tend to really come with all this bluster about, you know, look, China and, you know, it's the end of the West and, you know, America is over. I'm like, you know, empires don't fall apart overnight, you know, not traditionally. And usually it's always a lot more complicated than people want to make it out to be.
And I think it's very interesting you say that China has a kind of more reformist agenda on the international sphere. That is, they don't want to blow up the rules-based international order. They want a renegotiation of that rules-based international order because there are aspects of it that protect and allow for Chinese economic expansion, which at this present moment is extremely important. I mean, I think we can certainly link the cooling of rhetoric around Chinese-American relations as, you know, in part being motivated by rising unemployment in China. I mean, you know, the United States and China are like deeply linked in the international system, and there is decoupling in certain areas, but you go to Walmart.
Don't you mean de-risking? It's de-risking now.
De-risking, yes. De-risking in certain strategic industries, but like for your vast like majority of consumer goods, you know, this relationship is important to both sides. Both sides need each other. I mean, it's one of the bizarre outcomes of China's shift away from autarkic economic development towards integrating itself into the global market.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative in a lot of ways was and still is a way to offshore non-productive state assets, or what were once state-owned assets, right? A lot of these, you know, state-owned, either privatized or currently still state-owned construction companies and what have you, are, you know, China developed a great deal of capacity to build things, as everyone knows, not always building things that are actually useful in China, right? Everybody's seen the pictures of the, you know, the empty apartment buildings that they're building. So in a lot of ways, you know, the being able to engage with the Middle East and being able to, you know, take advantage of the international system in the way that they do, to do that is really critical to the Chinese government. And especially now, I mean, you know, China in 2013, when the BRI was starting, is not China in 2022, 2023, in terms of its financial health. You know, back then they had more money than they knew what to do with, and they were throwing it around like a drunken sailor. And that's why half of the BRI projects right now are in debt and are unserviceable debt, and they're going to need to renegotiate them and sustain them. China's often accused of like debt trap diplomacy here. It's not. It doesn't really try to take advantage of those debts in any kind of way that would resemble that. And more importantly, it wasn't like a concentrated strategy. It was just that they were like, yeah, finance, whatever. Hey, you want money, we got money, you know. So, you know, predictably, a lot of those investments weren't very good. There's also, you know, you talked about the decoupling, the de-risking thing. That's a huge factor here, too. One caveat to the story that I'm telling, where China is, you know, happy to free ride and et cetera, et cetera. And one of the reasons why it's becoming increasingly reformist is because, as I said, it has judged the risk that it is exposed to increasingly as an unacceptable amount of risk. What do I mean by that? I mean by for example, like the chip wars. That's the most prominent current example. One of Xi Jinping's sort of like flagship economic projects is this idea of dual circulation, which I'm not going to get into too much. But the important part of it for our discussion here is that he wants to sort of reform the economy in such a way that China is no longer as reliant on global supply chains that the West dominates. They don't want to be in a position where if the US says no more chips, China doesn't get any more chips and they have to scramble to figure out. That's an unacceptable risk. So that's the kind of thing they're trying to mitigate. In terms of these projects. And when it comes to, for example, the Middle East, the biggest unacceptable risk of the U.S. security system is the fact that the U.S. has the ability to blockade oil in the event of a conflict, a very realistic one. This is the one thing that really stirs up the military and Chinese nationalists. And I think it was like a month or so ago. Do you guys remember the kind of like tanker wars that were happening? You know, Iran seized the tanker. Yeah. So just very briefly, Iran seized a tanker that I believe was one of these complicated things, like flagged by, owned by a Western company and bound for somewhere, in Greece. And it was a Chinese owned boat, but it was very complex sort of situation. And it came out the very next day that the reason that they had done that was that it was in response to America seizing an Iranian oil tanker that was bound for China. And the Chinese press was very much focused on the second thing. And they were saying, you know, that this is not so much like, you know, the like People's Daily, but I mean, like the military newspapers and blogs and things like that were saying, maybe we need to start thinking about creating our own blue water fleet that's able to protect our shipping lanes, because America is already affecting the supplies of energy to our country, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is, you know, this is just the equivalent of like in America where people kind of have these overblown reactions as well. But it shows you there is a rising concern within the Chinese security establishment and within China in general and under Xi Jinping that we need to mitigate these risks to a certain extent. So I think that is a big, if China is extremely friendly with all of the countries in the Middle East, it's much harder to convince them to go along with any attempts to blockade China from oil, even in the event of a conflict. Just the last bit on this, like people often talk about closing the Straits of Malacca. I'm not a security expert, but I've spoken to them and they tell me that if you were to go to speak to the people who man the Straits of Malacca on the US military side and propose that to them, they would laugh you out of the room. I mean, you don't have the partnership, the political will on the part of their local partners to follow through with something like that. The US has less ability to just shut the Strait down than is commonly believed, right? This is something they advertise, but that's the reality of it.
Because that's going to hurt not just China, but Indonesia, exactly. Malaysia, Singapore, all those parts. And in terms of the Blue Water Fleet, I mean, I'm assuming also that there is the risk of developing a Blue Water Fleet for the Chinese. It's not just, you know, you have to spend resources on it, but India has this major Blue Water Fleet. And, you know, whereas it seems that China's land capacities and air capacities are superior to India when it comes, one area where India is extremely strong is in its naval tradition. And there is a risk of, you know, Chinese-Indian relations, but all this talk of BRICS becoming a counterpoint, from the Indian perspective, they have no desire to become second fiddle to China in the global political system, and they have a certain degree of military leverage that China has to be aware of.
Did you ask me a question
there? How do you see this in terms of Sino-Indian relations, in terms of what's driving a kind of push for a Blue Water Fleet or calls for a Blue Water Fleet? Do India-China relations play into this?
I'm just going to be really honest with you there. I'm not super familiar with the ins and outs of Sino-Indian relations, and I wouldn't want to sort of go on record in a live sort of thing talking about that. But I do know that one thing I can say is that if you look at, for example, the U.S. current engagement with India, there's no doubt in my mind that that is partially as a result of the way that Sino-U.S. relations are going right now. India sees China as a kind of competitor. There's been a lot of concern about, you know, China trying to develop ports. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but the port in Pakistan. India is very concerned about that. So I do think there is an element in India and in Indian-U.S. relations right now to sort of countering China's maneuvers in that respect. But I couldn't really give you a deeper analysis, unfortunately. Middle East and China, I feel like, is enough.
Pascal, do you want to hit up on the final question?
Yeah, so in terms of what we're seeing right now with these relationships going on, one of the things I want to ask you is that should we have expected China to have had a more extensive role in brokering a peace with Yemen in that relationship, since they had entered, on behalf of the coming together with China, with Saudi Arabia and Iran? Why wasn't there more of an expectation that they would negotiate a quicker kind of peace arrangement in that situation?
That's somewhere between a no and a hell no for me. China has negative leverage when it comes to the situation in Yemen. Shortly after the Saudi-Iran deal was announced, I believe it was Anton Oil, a Chinese oil company, announced that they were signing an oil deal with the Houthi government. And then like 2 weeks later, they said, actually, just kidding. We're really sorry. We didn't mean to do that. We apologize to anyone who thought that was happening. They said we didn't do our due diligence. And once we did it, we decided that this was an unacceptable investment. So China is not even unwilling, but is like seems to be actively discouraged from investing in that area. And outside of the ability to bring Chinese money into the region, I mean, what influence do they have? Like I said before, I see this deal in a lot of ways as sort of Saudi Arabia losing in terms of losing in the war against the Houthi government and trying to prevent them from taking power. They're running out of money. They've not been able to achieve their objectives. The Houthis are more entrenched than ever. And, you know, basically their agreement with Iran was to not continue to pursue that war. I mean, they're backing down And in some ways, this is a kind of maybe even face-saving method, right? Well, it's not that we lost. It's that we decided to normalize relations with Iran. And as a result of doing so, we have to just sort of make peace with the government there. The Houthis also have very clearly said that this deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia has nothing to do with us. We're not abiding by it. We're not related to it. They say that, you know, Saudi Arabia is a party to this conflict. They cannot be a negotiator. They cannot be a peacemaker here. And I think that's right. So I just to simply answer the question, I think that we shouldn't have that expectation. And the reason that China hasn't done anything with regards to that is because it simply has no ability to. Never forget that China does not understand the Middle East as well as they would like you to think, or indeed many regions of the world. China, just to give a great example of that, I mean, I know for a fact that China has good knowledge of Iran. There are area studies experts. There are many Chinese in government and in academia in China who speak way better Persian than I do, and obviously speak better Chinese than I do because they're native speakers and not just students of it. And when Xi Jinping went to Iran, or went to Saudi Arabia, you guys may remember this, there was a huge controversy because China endorsed a statement that the GCC released in which the UAE, which made reference to some of the UAE's claims over the three islands between the UAE and Iran, Greater and Lesser Abu Tumb and Abu Musa, which are currently administered by Iran, but it's a disputed territory sort of thing. Please, nobody crucify me for what position I'm taking on this. But, you know, they got really upset in Iran, mostly, I think, because of the underlying cause of the Xi Jinping's visit was really embarrassing because it showed how much influence Saudi had at a time when their relations with Iran were not going so well. But because the statement basically said the same thing China says about every conflict that it's friends with both sides of, which was that both parties should come together and negotiate and you know, on the basis of peace and mutual understanding and, you know, call it a ceasefire and, you know, not escalate into violence. And Iran said, how dare you suggest that this is even negotiable at all? What a ridiculous thing to say. And look, if China should understand one issue, it should understand sensitivities surrounding disputed islands and whether one should be able to suggest that the status of those islands are negotiable. It caused a huge kerfuffle in Iran. They summoned the Chinese ambassador. The Chinese ambassador had to be like, no, come on. You know, we don't really mean anything when we say these things. It's just boilerplate. Like, come on. And I think it was actually one of the reasons why they wanted to broker this deal, because China's strategy fundamentally, right, is to pursue relations with all parties. It can't do that if good relations with Iran, Saudi Arabia piss off Iran, right? So just to emphasize that even when they have the expertise, sometimes that expertise doesn't come to bear. And if with Iran, if they understand, you know, they are barely understanding Iran or getting things right at the final level with Iran, I can't imagine they have the capacity to do anything serious in Yemen.
Well, Bill, we are over an hour and I know you have limited time, but I did want to ask you one final kind of, I want to spring a fun question on you. Oh. We saw the recent death of this guy. we saw the recent death of the Iron Sheikh, probably the greatest wrestler of all time. He will break your back and make you humble if you go against him. Now, a lot of people don't know the story of the Iron Sheikh, and you said before the show that you had recently explained the story of the great Iron Sheikh. And you know his story. People might know the Iron Sheikh was not actually an Arab; he was a Persian. Could you give us a little bit of a talk about the Iron Sheikh, about like who this amazing guy was, who had his Twitter account seized by his grasping nephews beforehand? Anyone who follows the Iron Sheikh account and thinks it's awesome, that wasn't the Iron Sheikh posting that stuff. That was his like family. But can you talk a little bit about who the Iron Sheikh was?
Absolutely. I'm very, very happy to talk about this. I was really, really sad when he passed away. Just a little background on myself. I was a big fan of wrestling, professional wrestling when I was a kid. And I remembered the Iron Sheikh from those days, but until I was in my 20s, I had very little knowledge of or even interest in the Middle East. So it wasn't until recently when I was watching, on YouTube, a video of him, kind of going on a tirade, I suddenly realized he's speaking Persian. I can understand him. What the hell? I didn't know he was Persian. So I kind of, you know, looked into him from that. He has such a fascinating story. There's a great documentary about it called The Sheikh, which I'm not going to say anything that's not in that documentary, but just very briefly, the Iron Sheikh, real name, Khosrow Vazeri, who was at one time one of the most prominent wrestlers in Iran. If there was, if the most popular wrestler in Iran was this guy named Gholam Reza Takhti, then the Iron Sheikh was the second most prominent wrestler. He had a lot of interesting jobs over his career in Iran. He was once the bodyguard for the Shah, which is really interesting. You can act as at least one photo I've seen where you can see him in the background, and it's very clearly him if you look at the pictures. He was just an Iranian wrestler. And one day, and for those of you who don't know, wrestling is a major sport in Iran. And I mean Greco-Roman Olympic wrestling. It goes back thousands of years. It's very important culturally, politically, etc. So there's this guy, he's very, you know, a political sports figure, Gholam Reza Takhti, and he wins a competition. And as was tradition, he was brought before the Shah. And you know, this is a little bit apocryphal, but I believe this is actually something that happened. And the Shah allegedly said to him, you know, what do you want? You want a house? You want a woman? You want a car? You want money? You know, you won this competition. You brought glory to the nation. So I'm going to reward you in some way. And Takhti said, you know, take that money and invest it in the schools and invest it in the poverty, because the country needs that money. I don't need that money. And the Shah got very quiet and left. And about a week later, Gholam Reza Takhti committed suicide. And pretty much everyone knew and, you know, thought that it was the work of Savak, the secret service. And as Khosrow says in the documentary, he said to himself, if Iran is no good for Gholam Reza Takhti, then maybe Iran is no good for Khosrow Vazeri. And so from there, he moved to the United States with basically nothing. I think at first he was he spent some time coaching the U.S. Olympic team because he was a real Olympic wrestler. So when you see him giving these speeches where he's like, tell me what Olympic compete they win, you know, like he means it. Like those medals he's wearing, those are his real Olympic medals. It's fucking great. so he finds out, you know, he finds his way to the U.S. wrestling thing, which at that time, the WWF was regional. It was not the national system that you have now, but Vince McMahon was trying to take it to the national level. They had a great guy in, some of you may have heard of him before, Hulk Hogan, who was set to be their hero, right? They're like, here's our guy. I don't know if you guys know Hulk Hogan, but his thing is he is a real American, right? Fights for the rights of other men. You know, that's his theme song, you know? He's the all-American guy. So he needed a villain. You can't have a hero without a villain. So here comes Khosrow Vazeri. He wants to wrestle. They tell him it's fake, and he doesn't quite get it at first. And then when he realizes it, he's not about it at all. But he realizes he needs to eat, and he needs to have a job, and this is a way to do it. So he eventually not only goes along with it, but commits to it. He's like, if I was a great wrestler in this other system, then I'm going to bring that athleticism and that intensity, but also the performance that's necessary for this. And he learns how to generate what they called heat, you know, hatred from the audience, probably better than anyone else. There are stories of people like literally pulling knives on him after shows because he's, you know, he would come out and he would say, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, America. You know, he spits on the ground. Like, it's my favorite clip of him is he takes a turkey. It's like during Thanksgiving, and he's like this stupid turkey, and he like pretends to spit on the turkey. Like, he was just the epitome of anti-American everything. And you know, and this is also, if you watch the clips, this is like the very racist era of WWE, because his what do you name? What do you call it? Like his manager is like, I forget his name, but it's like Ayatollah Mike or something like that. It's a very regular American dude. And he's always in the background every time he's talking, going, Bally, 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 Bally. You know, it's just very, very bad Persian, you know? so he really throws himself into this, and he becomes the way that they sell Hulk Hogan to the nation. First, he wins the heavyweight title And everyone's like, oh my God, this anti-American guy won the heavyweight title. And then Hulk Hogan comes and takes it from him. And that's the moment that Hulk Hogan becomes a national star. That's the moment that wrestling kind of goes national. So the WWE, for those of you who are fans of it today, would not exist without the Iron Sheik. And I could continue to tell many, many stories about him. He eventually was, you know, kicked out of the organization because he broke kayfabe back when you weren't allowed to do it. Because
yeah,
which for those of you who don't know, it means you're the idea that they were supposed to
hate each other. I think he was caught. Yes. he was caught in a car with I forget who it was. Because
I can't remember either.
Next week we're having my brother on to talk about pro wrestling.
Oh, awesome!
We're having Dara Diablo, as he is known, Dara Diablo, who, because wrestling is like, it's a different era of wrestling. So he used to play a Mexican character, but people decided his fake Mexican accent was borderline racist. And so he just became.
Gee, I wonder why.
Well, he used to go wrestling all around the country and people would actually think he's a Mexican. So, so the Diablo has stayed. But he'll talk about the kayfabe.
That's great. That's great. I'll let you watch the documentary if you want to know about the rest of the Sheik's life. He has a really interesting story. He falls into drugs, you know, and then he gets reunited with his family. You should really watch it. It's great. I'll leave you with this thing that I think is really, really interesting. I'm sure all of you, especially if you like the TV show It's Always Sunny, have heard the word jabroni before, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jabroni is strongly associated with The Rock. He kind of originated it in its popular cultural usage. So many people think that he is the one who invented it. He's not. It was invented by the Iron Sheik. The Rock was a young wrestler, basically, at a time when the Iron Sheik was kind of, you know, one of the more prominent wrestlers. And they would have a lot of interactions backstage. You know, he kind of took him under his wing for various reasons. And jabroni was the Sheik's way of saying jobber, which is like wrestling slang for the guy who just comes in for the day. You wrestle him with one of your stars. He gets his ass kicked and then you move on. He's not like a really big deal. So he would just say, you know, these jabronis and all this stuff. And The Rock liked it. And so he started using it. And The Rock will tell you this himself, because it's an interview with him is how I know this is the case. So also, if you like the word jabroni, you can thank Khosrow for that as well.
There we go. Well, right. Bill, thank you very much for coming. I do hope we can have you on again in the future to talk about some more historical topics. It was a very informative discussion, and we really appreciate your time. I know it's getting late in the United Kingdom, and you will need to enjoy our fantastic British cuisine. So I'm hoping you're going to leave and go and have some beans on toast, perhaps even a Yorkshire pudding, maybe some tripe. Who even knows? But as we've gone a little long today, Pascal, do you want to say the magic words?
We are out.